AV Automotive LLC et al. Versus Gabergasis.
May it please the court, I'm Monica Monday on behalf of the appellants, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Imposing sanctions is one of the more serious actions that a trial court will make, and for that reason, it must carefully comply with Code Section 8.01 271.1 and the case law interpreting that statute. The trial court failed to do so here, and it abused its discretion both in awarding sanctions and in fashioning an appropriate sanctions award. So I'd like to start with the Audi penalty claim. And the question here is not whether AV had been penalized by Audi. The question is whether AV had formed after a reasonable reasonable belief that it had been penalized by Audi. Here, the trial court applied a duty to verify standard in its final order rather than a reasonable inquiry standard.
What was the best evidence that has been penalized and has been damaged, which is the language of the complaint, which is a past tense, not I think I might be in the future? What's the best evidence that they had incurred a $700,000 damage?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's found in the Liu affidavit, which is found at 995 of the joint appendix. And here, Mr. Liu identified and set forth AV's understanding of the program rules and the company's prior experience with these rules. The company had prior experiences. It had also had suffered a first offense. Mr. Liu contacted Audi to explain about the second offense, which is what gives rise to this particular action, and had a conversation where they discussed the rules. And the affidavit states that I knew from the program rules that there would be a chargeback upon this second offense because AV had been warned about the first offense.
I get that, but that's a complaint that says I've talked to my franchisor and I'm looking at a potential $700,000 damage, as opposed to a past tense, I've actually paid $700,000 in penalties.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that when we talk about the tense issue, that may put us into the realm of where it becomes doubtful. But doubtful cases and doubtful claims are not sanctionable. And here, when viewing the affidavit as a whole, this is a company that had prior experience. We have written rules, and the written rules, based upon this, AV formed a reasonable belief based upon those rules and the conversation with Audi that if you had this second offense, which they had just reported, it was basically automatic and they knew what the chargeback amount was. And that is set forth clearly in the affidavit.
Would your client have brought the case if it had never been done?
Absolutely. So that gets to the other point, which is let's look at the context of this claim. We were talking about a single damages claim in a $5 million suit with multiple legal theories. This isolated $700,000 penalty allegation was not essential to any legal claim raised in the case. So if we look at like the Gilmore case, here is where this court said we have to analyze legal and factual claims separately. And if you have a factual claim if you have a legal claim that is not dependent upon a sanctionable factual claim, it's not sanctionable. It's not essential to the claim. And so in that case, the unsupported factual claim was not necessary to the legal claim, and therefore it wasn't a basis for sanctions. The same rule applies here. You have one claim in this large action that none of the claims were dependent upon this. So in fact, this case has been refiled, without the Audi penalty claim allegations, and all the claims have survived and are going forward.
Counsel, the analogy I thought of is an auto accident case. You claim damage to the car, medical expenses, lost wages. Suppose lost wages is inflated or flawed and sanctionable, which I'm not asking you to concede, but you still have these other freestanding claims that can be disentangled.
Yes, and it is disentangled. That's exactly right. That's a perfect analogy, Justice McCullough, because here it was actually, even though you didn't have to specifically plead exactly what the damages were, we did. We said it was the lost compensation. That's itemized in the Second Amendment complaint. There were other elements of damage that survived even without this isolated claim. So it was not essential to anything, and it was also severable from the rest of the claims. And in fact, it has been severed from the claims.
Can I ask you this? Did the defendant incur any attorney's fees in this case at all?
Not at all, Your Honor, because someone else, the unnamed co-conspirator, it was undisputed, the unnamed co-conspirator is paying those fees.
Is there any evidence that the defendant has a legal liability to repay the fees or indemnify the co-conspirator?
There is no evidence of that, Your Honor. And therefore, we don't even believe that using the plain language of the statute that there have been any attorney's fees incurred in the case.
May I ask you about that? Because like in civil rights cases, you can have an ACLU or NAACP or whatever that is incurring fees in the sense of they're spending lawyer, you know, salaries or whatever. Or you could have parents with an impecunious child and they're paying the lawyer, but not the party that's actually being represented. So would that foreclose the ability of a trial court in those situations to impose sanctions because the specific litigant hadn't incurred those fees, even though fees were incurred in the general sense?
I think this is a very narrow situation, Your Honor. We have an admission on the record that the defendant is not paying the fees, has not paid the fees, and I think there could be other scenarios where that particular situation would not apply. So I think this is a very, very narrow situation.
How is this different from any other collateral source instance? Say, for instance, if it was her insurance company that was paying the attorney's fee.
Your Honor, I think it is because of the statutory language, the incurred language, that we have to look at that and determine whether you have, in fact, incurred any fees, whether you are liable or subject to those fees, and she's simply not. Now, I'll also point out...
Well, let's go to the insurance situation. So you're saying in that instance, you haven't incurred any fees if your insurance company pays, and so... In a sanctions case where there's like a insurance company on one side is paying somebody's attorney's fees, the court can never award attorney's fees.
No, Your Honor, but I think that in this particular situation, we are talking about sanctions when a trial court has a wide variety of available sanctions. There were a lot of things that the court could have done.
Like,
for example, I'm gonna strike your claim. We haven't gotten to the Conti example. I'm going to strike that expert. You know, I'm going to award you money, but not fees. There were a variety of alternatives, but the one that the defendant asked for, and the one that the trial court granted were fees. And under the statute, it's simply not permissible if the defendant has not incurred those fees.
But counsel, if you look at the other situations where the Chief Justice has cited, where insurance claims, medical claims, where the fees are, they're never liable for the fees because they're all written off or whatever, why would we take from the many sanctions or the many options the court has the attorney fee option when there are other areas of the law where it's not incurred, but they are allowed to proceed or recover for it? Or,
Your Honor, I think to respond to your answer, I continually go back to the because, you know, the because of, which we haven't really fleshed that out, but the because of the sanctionable pleading. If you haven't paid attorney's fees, then the sanction is not because of, you know, the attorney's fees and the sanctionable pleading. So we don't have that appropriate nexus between the two. The statute requires a nexus, and that is simply not present here.
So the nexus, wouldn't it be in the nature of an indemnity analysis, like a collateral source doctrine case? The victim does incur a damage. It's just someone else pays for the damage. But in your situation, the defendant didn't incur it in the first instance.
Did not. And I think here, particularly in a sanctions context, it is a different way. I mean, so for example, Your Honor, let me go back to your insurance. We're trying to compensate somebody there, right? This is not about compensation. This is about deterrence. So what we're doing is we're giving a windfall to a party who hasn't even incurred the fees.
So if she had a contract that said, you're going to pay my attorney's fees for me. Would that be I've incurred them and someone else is paying them on my behalf?
I think if there were a provision that ultimately indicated that the party was liable or subject to, then yes.
Technically she is liable. If the other person never pays.
There is no evidence of that on the record, Your Honor. And I think that could be, possible in another case, but it is not in this case. We have nothing in the record that she is subject to or liable for these fees in the event that the other party doesn't pay, and there's actually no evidence that the other party hasn't paid. So
how could that be in an attorney-client relationship? I mean, if I've got a lawyer, my mom's paying for the lawyer, and they're like, you know, people on the other side do some terrible things, the court imposes a sanction and says, and we're going to award attorney's fees. Like, his mama's paying for everything. You can't give him any money. I was like, yeah, but it came out of her pocket. Can't she get her money back? No?
Well, but that's not the party, Your Honor. That's not the moving party. And we're not trying to compensate that party. We're trying to do something different in this context.
Punish.
But even so, there shouldn't have been sanctions awarded at all. And let me talk briefly about the Conti deposition, and I also want to get to, you know, the amount of the award here. So the trial court, one of the other grounds for awarding sanctions was that AV designated what was essentially a fact witness, but designated them out of an abundance of caution as an expert witness to testify about fact matters, and this was an in-house expert. And the trial court awarded sanctions because we had designated him without the expert's knowledge. The expert testified consistent with what the disclosure was, and there was no evidence that there was any harm or prejudice suffered to the defendant because this witness didn't know that he was an expert. This would have an
Can
enormous...
Can I stop you just for a second? And maybe I missed something, but I thought in the expert interrogatory said he was going to testify as to damages that were incurred by his employer. And then he gets there and says, I had no idea they were going to use me, et cetera. And you know what? I don't know anything about any damages.
No.
I don't think they have any. I mean, so isn't that part of the problem, too?
No. In fact, Your Honor, he did testify. And the record shows that clearly, that he did testify. And you can see that at pages 559.
But I thought his testimony was that they didn't have any damages.
No, he said that they did. Also at 562 to 66. And he testified to the damages. He didn't testify about the $700,000 Audi penalty because he wasn't disclosed to testify about that. What he testified to was the compensation for the defendant, her bonuses and commissions, and also to the past lost profits of the company. This is all set forth in his deposition. And he also had reviewed his expert disclosure a month before. But it's important for parties to be able to rely upon these in-house experts who have important factual information. You know, if I want to call my accountant at the firm as an expert to testify, which was really a fact testimony, but about what somebody's earnings were or bonuses that they made that may relate to my damages claim, you know, that's completely different than a retained expert who doesn't even know that he's been retained, or you haven't gotten his opinion. So it's a completely different
expert
scenario.
Expert disclosure imply or even state that the $700,000 issue was going to be addressed by the expert?
It did, and let me be careful how I answer that question, Your Honor. It did mention the $700,000 bonus, but it did not mention it as a penalty. And so what it actually said was that the expert was going to talk about the $700,000 bonus and the Audi rules, but did not say that it was going that there was going to be any evidence offered as to a penalty. And in fact, it said that, you know, he would testify about the bonus payments, but there was no evidence that there was no designation or disclosure that he would testify about a penalty. That was off the table. And we also know that the defendant admitted, after we withdrew the Audi penalty allegation, admitted that it was withdrawn in a pleading, stating it has been withdrawn.
I don't understand what a precipice withdrawal is. It's not a pleading that I'm familiar with. It sounds like it's a little off the book sort of thing.
Well, and I don't think that we need to get to that point, because the important point here is that the defendant acknowledged there was a phone call, a written letter, outlined every single allegation that was withdrawn. May I finish answering the question?
Yes.
And then the defendant immediately, in the response to a demurrer, in bold print in the pleading, says, you know, AV has withdrawn the Audi penalty claim, and attached the letter that withdrew it. So I think in the context of this issue, in the context of a sanction, we can accept that withdrawal, and the defendant cannot approbate and reprobate today about whether or not we withdrew it. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is George Peterson. I represent the appellee in this case. I want to turn my attention first to something that was said by the appellant's counsel, and that is that the designation of Mr. Conte did not include anything with respect to the penalty for $700,000. I believe that maybe perhaps she misspoke when she said that. If you look at the joint appendix at page 91, I will quote, this is the expert designation. It's also carried forward in the amended one that was filed months later. It says that the Mr. Conte will testify about, quote, the bonus payments paid to Audi Arlington, including the CSI bonus, and the terms for the bonus payments and penalties, paren $700,000. So very clearly, they filed this document with the court identifying the $700,000 penalty in the expert designation. They did so again in July of 2019 in the amended designation, so the appellant's counsel misspoke on that point. With respect to the other issue that was raised and the questions were asked with respect to whether or not the attorney's fees were incurred, I think that the appellants in this case are reading something into the statute that's not there. They're suggesting that you need to add words to 801-271.1 about the hedges, what incurred means. 801-271.1 does not say that it has to be particularly incurred by a party in this case. It just has to be incurred. And I think that the court has...
By somebody else, not the party who is initiating the sanction?
We have a wide variety of examples, Your Honor, where
I get all that, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of discussion that could be had on every one of those hypotheticals,
yes.
But your situation is like the clearest of all situations. She paid no money whatsoever, incurred no liability, no future debt, no indemnity obligations, no contractual repayment provisions. She would get all this in addition to the money that's already been spent by a co-conspirator for the lawyers. She would basically get free money. How could that possibly be the proper interpretation of this statute?
Well, one, Justice Kelsey, I think that the record is not as crystal clear as you're making it out in the hypothetical. With respect to
the burden of proof is on you to show incurred, not on them to refute it.
No, but the only thing that they put into the record is a deposition transcript of my client where they simply asked the question of who's paying your attorney's fees. No follow-up questions about whether or not there was an obligation to repay. There's nothing that simply...
Is there?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, well, if it's your burden of proof of showing what incurred means, why doesn't that mean you lose the point?
I don't know that it is our burden to prove what they incurred. It's our burden to prove the incurred amount, or at least our initial burden to prove the incurred amount.
Well, it can't be an incurred amount until it's been incurred. So what is your evidence it was incurred?
Well, the attorney's fees affidavit was cited, was filed with the record. The extensive billing records, which took up...
So it's incurred by somebody, but not the party that's entitled to the sanction.
I think that that's would be adding language into the statute, Your Honor. I think that you should be very careful about accepting the appellant's invitation to add that additional requirement in 801-271.1, because, as cited in our appellee's brief, there are a wide variety of circumstances where sanctions would simply become unavailable. You cited a number yourself. I think Justice Powell had one as well.
Each one of those examples, from my perspective, involve other doctrines of law, doctrines of indemnity, doctrines of implicit right to repayment. doctor, like collateral source incurred but paid by someone else. We're dealing with the threshold question of incurred at all by a party that's seeking them. And your whole argument, I think, is, well, it's incurred by somebody else other than the party seeking them. That's good enough. I don't know how it works.
Well, I don't think that the statute requires, it has specific about how or who incurs the attorney's fees in this case. Another example, which we touched upon in our brief, was an issue where what happens when you have a pro bono case. If at that point where someone is an attorney, who we all want to encourage pro bono work in this Commonwealth, has taken on a case pro bono, and yet the other side now sees it as free license to violate 80171.
It's not a free license. The sanctions under that statute go far much further than simply, well, you can take a person off the rolls of the court for a temporary period of time under the sanctions statute.
It depends on whether their client was the one that was the recalcitrant party. So you could have a recalcitrant party who basically drags on a case, files frivolous or takes frivolous position after frivolous position, and then suddenly, because the attorney had taken the case on pro bono, 801-271 or any teeth in 801-271.1 is out the window. And I don't think that's the intentment of the statute. If you look at
how did the pro bono lawyer, let's deal with the pro bono situation since we're in all these other hypotheticals. If I'm a pro bono lawyer, I'm a pro bono lawyer, period. And I don't charge fees. I don't expect fees. I don't claim fees. Now, if there's a 1988 prevailing party statute that gives fees, that's a whole separate question. So why does the pro bono issue construe the statute to say you still don't have to incur it if you're a good guy and you're a pro bono?
One is, I think that even if someone was handling a matter pro bono, if they had additional work they had to do in order to bring the matter before the court on a motion for sanctions, that certainly would be an appropriate remedy or something that they should be available for the court to award in those instances as an approximation. Taking it outside the context of pro bono, you have issues where plaintiff's counsel take cases on contingency fees. In those instances, if there was pure, plainly sanctionable conduct by a defendant in those cases, you would have an argument coming back that, well, the plaintiff in this case had a contingency fee, so they didn't incur any attorney's fees as related to the sanctionable conduct. I think this court should be
incur a liability for potential attorney's fees.
Only it's if you took a look at a straight contingency fee, Justice Kelsey, it's based upon contingent upon the outcome. And so, you know, it's only upon contingent outcome. It's not varied depending upon how sanctionable the conduct was. It's usually, if you look at a plaintiff's contingency fee, it's a third or perhaps a 40% of the recovery. So there is simply no way, to monetize that in terms of when you're looking at other areas of law. I think the court should be concerned about how you would narrowly craft this or graft this requirement into 801-271.1, where, again, I don't think there is any, Your Honor. Coming back to it, I think that the real prime issue here, Your Honor, is whether the trial court in this instance abused its discretion when it awarded attorney's fees in light of the fact that AV repeatedly throughout its pleadings and in the expert designation lied about being penalized $700,000. If you look at the original complaint.
And counsel, the part I don't understand is the idea that the entirety of the fees, everything pivots on this. It seems completely implausible that this one allegation, I mean, surely you investigated other factual and legal issues, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the trial court answered that very clearly. If you look at the trial court's final
order. I know what the court said. I'm just saying it seems completely implausible. The hypothetical that I gave to opposing counsel is it's one aspect of their damages, and there's all these other factual allegations. And you say, everything pivots on that. But how is that plausible?
One is they deliberately chose to intermix this one false allegation through virtually every count of every iteration of the amended complaints. And so the trial court, when it tried to look in terms of this, in terms of assessing the attorney's fees, made that determination. That was the.
But that's not. I don't see how that's plausible. Is what I'm saying.
I think it's certainly plausible when you try and look at the scope of what this complaint was, Your Honor. This was the bread and butter of their complaint. The other ones were based on very speculative conduct.
But wasn't there an earlier complaint that didn't mention this and then a later complaint that didn't mention it? So why'd you get fees on that?
So the original complaint actually alleged that there were damages as a result of it. If you take a look at it's in Joint Appendix 8 and Joint Appendix 12, this is the original complaint that they filed. They alleged that they were damaged as a result of these alleged bogus customer surveys. So they made the allegation that they had been damaged, which was false, in the original complaint. It got sustained in a demur, and they came back and they basically doubled down. At that point, they came back and all the operative iterations of the amended complaints, they said that, quote, AV has been penalized by Audi USA. It had been. So, and then they went on to say that they were required to, quote, repay bonus monies back to Audi USA for the entire time when the false customer surveys were in play.
But there's all these specific factual allegations. Then you get to damages, and there's this one specific allegation as to damages. And what you're saying is that's just so interwoven. But how could that plausibly be the case?
I think if you read the nature of this complaint, it's the first allegation is that there were these alleged bogus customer surveys, which were done by this unindicted co-conspirator. My client apparently was alleged to have been brought along on the ride. But when you take a look at it, that's the prime claim they're making. It's the centerpiece of their first allegation they're making throughout all of these allegations. The other ones, Your Honor, if you take a look at them, are highly speculative. The other real claim that they have in there is that there were alleged bogus employee surveys, which led to this employee leaving and then going elsewhere, and they were damaged as a result of that.
But shouldn't there be some segmentation on the final number?
If it were pragmatically possible, it should be, Your Honor. I absolutely agree. But again, you know, we're looking at the trial court. The trial court had this before them, had a dearth of material in terms of what the attorney's fees were. The trial court made the determination that because the appellant in this case chose to intermix this false allegation throughout all these various counts of these amended complaints, that it was pragmatically impossible to do so.
But didn't at least one claim survive demur?
It did, Your Honor.
Right, so how can you get, with a claim that survives a demur, and you say that's sanctionable too?
The sanctionable claim survived demur too, Your Honor. It was only that when, through the process of discovery, and going through the process of discovery, did my client determine or find out that this was a patently false allegation. So I think the fact that a facially plausible claim can be made and survives demur, I don't think it's a standard on sanctions, Your Honor. It's whether at the time the pleading was filed, whether it was well-grounded in fact. And that's clearly not the case here. They never had any evidence of being sanctioned or penalized $700,000 by Audi.
It's been refiled, I take it, from this record?
Well, let me be clear, Your Honor. So the answer is it has been refiled. It's not in the record other than the promise by the appellant's counsel below that he was darn sure going to refile it. And to answer your question, outside the record, yes, it has been refiled.
You don't have to respond, but I would assume the Audi $700,000 penalty is not there.
I'm not counsel record in that case, Your Honor. I don't know. I would accept the appellant's counsel's representation on that. It's not, but I can't tell you one way there. I haven't seen the pleadings, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With respect to the issues in this case, I think that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in this instance. If the court does believe that it needs to be segmented, then I think that it calls for a remand, not a reversal in this instance. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
I did have one additional question. I'm looking at page 758 of the appendix, where with respect to Mr. Conti, what the court said in its order was that he was designated without his knowledge. So in other words, in the briefs, there's all this stuff about, well, he alluded to the $700,000, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't seem to have been the basis for the sanction. The basis for the sanction was he was designated without his knowledge. And then counsel for the other side points out, well, but he was in-house, and they did as an abundance of caution because they thought it was mainly a fact witness. Isn't that a little different than a retained expert and so on?
I don't think it is. There's basically being designated to testify about a source of damages, and I think that, whether he's in-house or outhouse, outside counsel or outside, not outside counsel, but outside expert, I don't think really matters. I do think with respect to it, it's really harmless error if the court finds that there was a sanctionable basis based upon the trial court's first rationale, and that is that the AV repeatedly lied about this $700,000 penalty.
But wouldn't that go to the segmentation of the damages if the court does not find that the designation of Mr. Conti was problematic and the actions related to the court-ordered deposition dates, which are the other mm-hmm. two reasons
yes.
that the court cites three reasons for sanctions, if those two fail, shouldn't there be a segmentation or reduction?
I don't know that it's possible, given the trial court's finding in this instance, Your Honor, that because this highly sanctionable claim was intermixed throughout all these various counts of complaint, I don't know that it's segmentable. I think at the end of the day, we're getting to the same place, Your Honor. In terms of it, and the reality of it is the trial court expanded on its reasoning and rationale for the first basis. The trial court didn't provide much rationale for the second. It could have very clearly have found that the issues with respect to Mr. Conti and the issues with respect to the depositions were an effort to delay discovery of the sanctionable conduct. And I think in that context, I don't think it would alter the equation, Your Honor. Have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. It's Monday, I believe you don't have any time left for rebuttal. Court is adjourned. Thank you all very much.